Hello and welcome back to Food Toxicology. I'm Greg Muller, the instructor for the course. Well, today what we're going to do is actually tap on several of the different areas of food toxicology we've talked about thus far in the course. We're especially going to go back and reflect on the ecology of food that we introduced in one of the lectures in terms of trying to understand the relationship between organisms and their food chains. Today, what we're going to do is perhaps delve into the microecology of food, talk about bacterial toxigenesis. What we're not going to do today, this is not a food microbiology or a microbiology class, but we're going to focus on the chemical toxins, these primary and secondary chemicals that are made by bacteria and how they impact human health and the human food chain. This, I think, will be a very interesting lecture in terms of toxicology on a very, very small scale, but with dramatic impacts in terms of human health and disease. Our learning objectives here today, what we're going to try to do, is define bacterial toxigenesis. We're going to use that to explore the various types and varieties of bacterial toxins, some of their background, a little bit about their nomenclature. We'll try to differentiate the two major categories of bacterial toxins, endotoxins and exotoxins, and try to give you at least a broad stroke understanding of the differences and, in a certain sense, the similarities in terms of why bacteria might use these particular chemicals in terms of their own survival. We'll try as well to explore some of the toxicity properties and modes of actions of exotoxins. We won't go into this in great detail, again, because this is a complete area of study that could be dealt with in multiple courses in terms of the impact of these pathogenic bacteria, their mode of action, and their different toxins that they may produce. We'll try to and then slip into a little bit more important area in terms of food toxicology, and that's endotoxins, or pyrogens as they're called. They're called pyrogens because they induce fever. And we'll try to understand their toxicity, some of their properties, mode of action, again in a bit of a broad stroke. This is intended to be an introductory, a familiarization lecture, again to try to learn about that interface between chemistry and biology that we call toxicology. In this case, the chemistry are chemicals that are produced by biological organisms in a very similar way as we've talked about secondary plant chemical compounds and your understanding of various insect and animal venoms. We'll try to understand endotoxins and their influence on human disease and the development of sepsis. We'll try and then finish off with a little bit of a short review on how workers in the field, how people in the food sciences, the pharmaceutical sciences, especially try to detect endotoxins, to look at process control, to study the safety of food products, the safety of drugs and medical devices. Again, because endotoxins are heat stable, and because they're heat stable, the normal HACCP or microbiological controls that we use in food and food processing may not actually reduce the toxicity of the residual toxicants from the biologicals. Well, in terms of bacterial toxigenesis, we can define this as the ability to produce toxins. Just very simply, this is one of the mechanisms of bacterial disease. We can divide these into two broad categories of toxins, the cell-associated coatings or lipopolysaccharides, LPSs, you'll hear us talk about quite a bit today. These are referred to as endotoxins. And the other major category are exotoxins, and these are extracellular diffusible toxins. And again, some of these are associated with many pathogens that are common in terms of a discussion of human health and disease. Now, in terms of broader kind of descriptive identities of bacterial toxins, I have several definitions or descriptions out of various authors in terms of what these chemical compounds are and what they do. The first one here is that they are these bacterial toxins or these substances are toxic to eukaryotic cells as measured in a variety of ways. It can also be defined as a microbial substance able to induce host damage. Another definition for you is that it is any microbial product or substance that is harmful or lethal to cells, tissue cultures, or organisms. That's an ATLAS definition. You can also consider bacterial toxins to be common and a serious cause of tissue damage in bacterial infection. It's determined by the disease manifestation of microbes is actually determined by the production of these microbial toxins to a degree. These bacterial toxins are important determinants of microbiological or bacterial virulence, and we'll see that in terms of exotoxins. Another definition for us, microbial toxins are components or products of microorganisms which, when extracted and introduced into host animals, can reproduce disease symptoms. So it has independent action beyond the production from the biological source. And these disease symptoms are normally associated with the infection without infestation by those microorganisms. And so that gives us a sense that we're dealing with chemicals and the manifestation of a toxicosis, a biologically induced toxicosis, and an intoxication, if you will. Now, in terms of coming up with the terminology and nomenclature for bacterial toxins, you've heard me say exotoxin. This is an extracellular protein, typically toxin, whereas endotoxins are associated with the lipid A portion of the cell wall, the outer cell wall of gram-negative bacteria. Another major category in terms of nomenclature are enterotoxins, and these are ones that act on the GI tract. They're typically associated with food processing, food poisoning symptoms. These are the ones that concern us most, perhaps, in food toxicology. But in terms of the broader nomenclature of bacterial toxins, we find that they're named for the various host cells that can be attacked, like cytotoxins or neurotoxins. They can be named in terms of the producer or the disease, like cholera or Shiga toxin. You'll see them named for particular biochemical activities or specificity, as well as just coming up with letter designations to differentiate them from other bacterial toxins. Now, in terms of comparing endotoxins and exotoxins, we need to understand that endotoxins are cell-associated substances and that they are structural components of the outer membranes of these gram-negative bacteria. They can be released from growing cells, especially during exponential growth periods. They can be released from cells which are lysed from effective host defenses, for instance, by lysozymes, which pierce the cell membrane. They can be released from the activities of certain antibiotics. The important point here is that the chemical, the toxin at this point in time, can exist and have virulence independent of the death of the host of the infecting bacteria. Now, exotoxins are usually secreted by bacteria, but in some cases they are also released by the lysis of the bacterial cell. It's important to note that with a growing colony of bacteria, there is this chance for increasing concentrations of these toxins and therefore a dose response in terms of the health of the host and the response, the potential response from the increase of dose as the bacterial counts increase. Now, if we focus a little bit on exotoxins, we find that these are the most well-characterized family of toxins. They're secreted as soluble proteins, and so they're protein toxins. They enter eukaryotic cells primarily through receptor-mediated endocytosis. Some of these infections can involve local colonizations. Sometimes there can be a systemic disease which occurs distal to the site of the original infection. And so these disease courses are pretty significant in terms of management of the health of the host. In a broad category, there are two different types of endotoxins. These are membrane-acting toxins, and the other category is toxins with cytosolic targets. Some of the mode of action of these various types of exotoxins include damaging the membranes by forming pores, allowing leakage and transport of materials that should not be outside the cell or inside the cell. They can inhibit protein synthesis. They can activate other pathways, messenger pathways. They can act as superantigens and activate immune responses. They can also act as protease enzymes. Some of these exotoxins, they're typically soluble and they are secreted by living bacteria. We find that although in many kind of historical accounts of exotoxins, they're more likely to be associated with gram-positive, we find now that they are found in both gram-positive and gram-negative bacteria in terms of these soluble protein toxins. Some of these toxins, they're actually particular to a specific bacterial species. And so the toxin associated with a tetanus clostridium will be a tetanus toxin. Another diphtheria toxin will be associated with the bacteria that produced that particular toxin. We find that the virulence of the exotoxins are associated with the particular bacterial strain. Some bacteria of a particular species will produce a high level of toxin or virulence associated with the toxin. This particular toxin production is the determinant of virulence within a bacteria strain. If we take a look at comparing endotoxins as a toxicant in terms of traditional toxicity comparisons that we have been doing here in food toxicology, you'll see on this chart a fairly wide range of toxins, botulism, tetanus, Shigella neurotoxin, diphtheria. The second column gives us the toxic dose. All of these doses are on the order of 10 to the minus 5th to 10 to the minus 8th milligrams, so very low toxic dose to rodents, mice, and rabbits and guinea pigs. If we look at a ratio of what the toxic dose is in terms of the ratio to strychnine or endotoxins, these lipopolysaccharides or snake venoms, we find that the exotoxins are on the order of a million times or more lethal in terms of a comparison. Bacterial protein toxins are found to be the most powerful human poisons known, and they do retain high activity at very high dilutions. Now, protein toxins, in terms of how they actually resemble enzymes. They are denatured by heat, acid, and proteolytic enzymes. Like enzymes, they have high biological activity. Most of these can act in a somewhat catalytic fashion. They have high specificity for particular substrates, target cells, target organs, or target aspects of body fluids, typically hemolytic. Some of these bacterial toxins have a highly specific mode of action. The site of damage caused by the toxin indicates the location of the substrate, so sometimes our nomenclature, endotoxins, neurotoxins, will tell us that, in fact, for example, a certain toxin will impact neurons. Some of these, for example, tetanus, are toxins that attack only neurons. Some of these toxins, however, have very broad cytotoxic activity, and they'll end up with causing a broad necrosis, necrotic action across many sorts of cells and tissues. Staphylococci, streptococci, clostridia are some of these types of bacteria. There are other toxins that are broadly lethal with unknown specific mode of actions. An example of this is the anthrax toxin. We find that these protein toxins are strongly antigenic, so there's an immune interaction. What we find is that in vivo, the antibody or antitoxin in this particular case, it would be called, does neutralize the toxicity of bacterial proteins. Typically, lethality or serious disease is associated with the inability of the immune system to compensate for the toxic effects. Quite often you find that sometimes the antitoxin is associated with an antigen that is used in therapy. Protein toxins are inherently unstable. So what we find is that in time they do lose their toxic properties, but they do retain their antigenic properties. And this is a useful thing because this allows us to develop toxoids, which are detoxified toxins, and these can be detoxified in a variety of different ways. And they allow us to use those toxoids to immunize hosts, whether it be animals or humans, against these bacterial toxins. These toxoids are accelerated by treating the toxins with a variety of reagents, including formalin, iodine, pepsin, and others. Typically, they're incubated at 37 degrees in circumneutral pH for several weeks. These resulting toxoids can then be used for artificial immunization. It's an important part of animal health and human health. We, for instance, use it in our kids for diphtheria and for tetanus vaccinations. We find now with the advent of biotechnology that these toxoids can be genetically engineered in terms of having the same immunization quality especially for bacterial toxins where toxoid production is limited. If we switch over now to gram-negative bacteria and the production of endotoxins, we find with endotoxins that they are an important part of the toxicity of these organisms. It's not the total, but it is the most important part. And again, we go back to some gram-negative bacteria can produce protein exotoxins. These endotoxins have a disease manifestation in conditions such as septicemia, toxic shock syndrome, and sometimes in food poisoning. These endotoxins are lipopolysaccharides, and they are part of the cell membrane envelopes. We'll show you in a few pictures here what exactly that means. The interesting part of these endotoxins is that the killed bacteria can still release the endotoxins as they decay. And so there is virulence, or there is capacity to cause disease, even though we're dealing with a well-prepared food, a sterile substrate. The residual chemicals, which are heat-stable, have the ability to have toxic action. These endotoxins, or pyrogens as they are called, they do cause a wide variety of serious conditions, and these can include fever, shock, changes in blood pressure, and other circulatory functions. And we'll see some statistics in terms of human health and disease that this is in fact a very serious pathway in terms of human disease. We find that endotoxins are toxic to most mammals. We find that regardless of the bacterial source, all of these have the bacterial endotoxins have the same range of biological effects in the animal host. Most of what we know about endotoxins comes from examining experimental animals and not necessarily the study of natural disease. We find that the injection of living or killed gram-negative cells or some purified lipopolysaccharides into experimental animals in terms of toxicology trials, these cause a wide spectrum of nonspecific pathophysiological reactions. These reactions include fever, and again, the pyrogen name, changes in white blood cell counts, disseminated intravascular coagulation, they cause coagulation. Hypotension, shock, and death. And so this is a progression that is largely referred to as sepsis. Injection of fairly small doses of endotoxins can result in the death of most mammals. The sequence of events follows a very regular pattern. There's a latent period that's followed by a physiological distress that includes diarrhea, prostration, and shock, and finally death with a sufficient amount of endotoxin. How soon the death occurs is dose-related. It's related, as in all toxicology, to the route of administration, for example, intraperitoneal versus food, and as well the species of animal. Various animals do vary in their susceptibility to endotoxins. Now, if we compare exotoxins and endotoxins, we find that endotoxins are quite a bit less potent and they are less specific in their action. And they do not act in an enzymatic fashion like exotoxins do. The problematic aspect of endotoxins is that they are heat stable. Again, so sterilization, boiling, heat treatment, retorting does not necessarily reduce the virulence of these particular bacterial toxins. There are some powerful oxidizing agents that can minimize or neutralize endotoxins. We also find that endotoxins, although they are antigenic and they do impact the immune system, they cannot be converted or denatured into toxoids. And so immunization against endotoxins is not then possible. Some of the characteristics, if we compare endotoxins and exotoxins, from a chemical nature point of view, endotoxins are lipopolysaccharides. The molecular weight is on the order of 10 kilodaltons, whereas exotoxins are proteins, and so their molecular weight is going to be 50 to 1,000 kilodaltons. In terms of the relationship to the bacterial cell, the endotoxins are part of the outer membrane, whereas the exotoxins are extracellular and diffusible outside of the bacterium. In terms of the potential for denaturing by boiling, endotoxins perhaps weakly, but exotoxins are denatured by boiling. As I just said before, the capacity to form a toxoid for potential immunization is not available with endotoxins, but it is a potential for exotoxins. The potency on a relative basis, you saw from the previous comparison chart that endotoxins have a relatively low potency. You'll need greater than 100 micrograms to elicit a toxic endpoint, whereas exotoxins are highly toxic and typically 1 microgram, and in some cases less than 1 microgram. The specificity in terms of targets, as I had said, is low for endotoxins, but very high in terms of exotoxins. In terms of behaving like enzymes, endotoxins don't, but exotoxins usually do. And in terms of pyrogenicity, the ability to cause fever, this is why endotoxins are called pyrogens. This is a characteristic, and we sometimes find that as well with exotoxin intoxication. Now we find that the role of toxins, bacterial toxins in food-borne disease are interesting in that if they are consumed as preformed, in other words, a food substrate has perhaps had substantial microbial activity, but in the food processing or preparation, the actual bacteria were killed off. There still will be a level of toxins in that, but that level of toxins is a fixed dose at that point in time because the bacterium themselves that are capable of making the toxin have been killed by processing. So there is a self-limiting aspect to that. These toxins are produced by colonized bacteria, and so they can have a local or a distal effect. They can be considered to be produced by the infecting bacteria to aid invasion, although the evolutionary and ecological reasons in terms of the role of these toxins and the production of these is an active research area. We do find that these toxins do have a potential autoimmune response to these superantigen properties that they have. We also find that this immune response can lead to a cascading series of physiological effects that will lead to shock and potential sepsis. Next two slides, what I've done is take a listing of some of the organisms that are often recognized for foodborne intoxications. As you go down these lists, Staphylococcus, Clostridium, Botulinum, Vibrio, you'll see that these are the ones, if you've taken food microbiology, are the ones that come across our plates, so to speak, far too often in terms of human health and disease. In terms of agents of foodborne infections that also produce toxins, again, a listing of gram-negative and gram-positive bacteria that produce various types of toxins of foodborne concern. Now, if we go back to the books, so to speak, and take a look at bacterial cell structures, we can see start seeing that in terms of differentiating endotoxins and exotoxins, we can look at gram-negative and gram-positive bacteria in terms of their morphological characteristics to try to come up with a better understanding of the whole background of toxin production by bacteria. In this simplified cartoon, this breaks down the major components of a bacterial cell. Of most importance to today's lecture actually is out here in terms of the capsule, the cell wall, and the plasma membrane. Here is where we find significant differentiation in terms of gram-positive and gram-negative bacteria, and that also gives us the potential for production of endotoxins in gram-negatives. If we take a look at electron microscopy of bacterial cell walls, you can see that in a gram-positive bacteria, the peptoglycan and the cytoplasmic membrane are tightly held in terms of the outer wall of the cell, whereas in gram-negative bacteria, we have an additional layer, this outer wall layer, a little bit of space, and then the cytoplasmic membrane, and then the peptidoglycan layer beneath it. If we take a look at that, not in SEM, but in a cartoon, we can see that in the gram-positive cell wall, we do have these two layers, but we have an additional layer and a little bit more space in a gram-negative cell wall. It's this outer membrane that's of most interest in terms of bacterial toxins. The gram-positive cell wall, you'll see that structurally, we've got the plasma membrane, and then we have the cell wall itself. In a gram-negative cell wall, we have the plasma membrane. Then we have this cell wall that also has this outer membrane, which has a lipoprotein phospholipid layering as well. In terms of this lipopolysaccharide outer layer in gram-negative bacteria, it is a major constituent of the outer surface of these membranes. It gives the colonies a smooth appearance. It covers about 75% of the outer membrane. In terms of the mass of the cell, it's about 3 to 10% of the total dry cell weight. In terms of molecule counts, there's about 3 to 4 million lipopolysaccharide molecules per cell. And so this can be considered as to a major constituent, a major constituent of gram-negative bacteria. In terms of the molecular structures of the LPS, we find a good consistency in terms of these particular chemicals. You can break the lipopolysaccharides down to three major components. This is on the right in the red and white, a space-filling diagram, and here is molecule breakdown. The lipid form is lipid A down here, which has a good conservation in terms of different species of bacteria. There's a core polysaccharide zone here that's highlighted by various types of unique saccharides. And then on the outer part, the O side chain, which does have a fair amount of diversity from species to species. In terms of where we get most of the toxicity, the lipid A part of the lipopolysaccharide is a powerful biological response modifier that has the capacity to stimulate the mammalian immune system. What happens is this is released, this molecule is released, and this is the end that appears to have an immunogenic property. If we take a look at lipopolysaccharide, lipid A's, as from various types of bacteria, such as Salmonella in here, you can see across the different bacteria highlighted in this particular graphic, that there's reasonable conservation in terms of structural similarities of the lipopolysaccharide, especially looking at lipid A. There is diversity there, but reasonably good conservation of structure. In terms of the mode of action of these lipopolysaccharides, we find that they can be bound by plasma proteins into LPS binding proteins or LPBs. There can also be action of free LPSs in terms of the cytosol. These LPBs will interact with receptors on monocytes and macrophages and other types of receptors and start a chain of events. There are three events that are triggered following this interaction. The first major event is the production of cytokines such as interleukin and tumor necrosis factor. These can stimulate production of prostaglandins and leukotrienes, inflammatory chemicals, and start the process towards septic shock. The next step in the process is activation of a complement cascade, which can cause an immunological release of histamine release, and this release will lead to vasodilation. The end product here at this step is inflammation. The third major mode of action is activation of a coagulation cascade. This is a cascade of biochemical and physiological effects that lead to enhanced thrombosis and coagulation and the potential for internal bleeding as the platelets and clotting factors are depleted in the early stages of the disease. This then gets followed by inflammation and hypotension in terms of the pathway to sepsis. So if we examine the inflammation to sepsis pathway, these lipopolysaccharides, the net effect is inducing inflammation, intravascular coagulation, and hemorrhage and shock. We find that LPS, these lipopolysaccharides, can also act as immune system B-cell mitogens, stimulating the production of additional immune cells, and we'll show this in terms of the cycle or pathway here in a moment. In terms of the inflammation cycle resulting from infection or intoxication, this cartoon gives you kind of a quick lesson in immunology. Here we've got the lipopolysaccharides, gram-negative bacteria, gram-positive bacteria, or some of the inflammation chemicals, tumor necrosis factor, interleukin. What we find is that the impact in terms of immune cells, pituitary cells, macrophages, T cells, will release a MIF or macrophage migration inhibitory factor. This is a pro-inflammatory cytokine, and it does act as a critical mediator of septic shock. And so as the immune system is gearing up and to challenge the initial infection or intoxication, it starts a cycle in terms of release of some of these inflammatory chemicals, TNFs and interleukins, and glucocorticoids as well. In terms of looking at this from a receptor based on some of these epithelial cells. On the left-hand side of this cartoon, you see an E. coli cell with the lipopolysaccharides. These lipopolysaccharides have the capacity to have direct binding and activation to various toll receptors. These toll receptors on cells cause release of the antimicrobial peptides like tumor necrosis factor and various inflammatory cytokines like interleukin. There can also be a binding protein-mediated LPS as well. And again, the cascade of impacts in terms of chemotaxis in the cell, communication, chemical communication within the cell, and the cell responding in terms of developing and releasing some of the pro-inflammatory chemicals leading to septic shock. From a cellular basis, we can look at the inflammation cycle as well in terms of our adaptive immune systems. What this cartoon does, and I'll let you kind of go through it on the lecture notes, on the lecture slides. This isn't an immunology class, but in general, what we have is an antigen here that is interacting with macrophages, for example, and then stimulating the various productions and responses of T cells, memory T cells, and B cells associated with cell-mediated immunity and humoral immunity in our adaptive immune system. What we find in terms of an immunological response of to these endotoxins, the amounts which trigger the response are very, very low. In humans, that can range, that can be from picograms to milliliters and nanograms to milliliters in rats. If we look at it, step back a little bit more in terms of the manifestation of bacterial toxin disease, typically the outcome is a generalized sepsis. This is a graphic following the arrows in terms of the presentation of infection at the top part. There's an immediate immune system response. There's a release of mediators from white blood cells and vascular endothelium. The cascade of effects include increased inflammation, increased coagulation, decreased fibrinolysis, and then endothelial damage, leaks, if you will. That will move down to the next stage in the cascade, altered tissue perfusion, microthrombi, capillary leaks, leaky vessels. You then cascade down into organ system dysfunction because of disrupted blood flow, edema formation, swelling, and finally ending in death, unfortunately far too often. The facts about severe sepsis in the U.S., there's about 1 million cases per year. In Europe, this number is about 500,000 cases per year. The mortality is variable. It ranges from about 25% to about 50% or more. In the U.S., sepsis kills about 215,000 people per year. It's got about the 10th rank in terms of human disease. In terms of cost of healthcare, this is about $17 billion per year in U.S. health costs. Now, because of this substantial concern in terms of the numbers of people impacted and the cost in terms of human health and national treasure, if you will, in terms of health management, detection of endotoxins or pyrogens is an important part of several aspects of medicine and the food industry. In terms of the pharmaceutical industry for intravenous chemicals, because these endotoxins are heat stable, there has to be a mechanism of removing them or limiting their production during the production and processing of various drugs and medical devices. They do track bacterial counts to make sure it's minimized because lower bacteria counts are going to lower the potential endotoxin production. There are also concerns in terms of environmental monitoring, animal handling, for example, chicken and egg production, slaughterhouses, their wastewater or sewage treatment plants. There's significant amount of potential for airborne endotoxin contamination. Endotoxins are all around us. They're in our home. They're in the dust that we breathe. We do a pretty good job at low-level exposure. It's when you have high-level occupational exposure that it becomes a significant concern. There can be occupationally induced asthma, inflammation, irritation of the lung tissue associated with breathing the endotoxins that are normal and proliferative in the dust associated with animal handling operations. We can also find the importance in terms of detection of endotoxins in human medicine, the detection of gram-negative bacterial infection, and the diagnosis of sepsis. We do have in pharmacological products limits, FDA limits in terms of pyrogens that are allowed in these products. Amoxicillium, this is an antibiotic, 0.25 endotoxin units per milligram. Water for intravenous infusion, 0.25 endotoxin units per milligram. For example, therapeutic devices for CSF contact, 0.06 endotoxin units per milliliter. One endotoxin unit is equal to 0.2 nanograms of lipopolysaccharide, and so the limits are extremely low. This is an active area in terms of management of product quality control in the pharmacological industry. Now, the question that arises then is how, if it's of such great importance, especially great importance as in very, very low levels, how do we actually detect these chemical compounds in routine analysis? For several decades, we've done biological tests, and we continue to do them for various types of application. In recent decades, actually, we've come up with a couple of non-biological endotoxin detection analyses as well. The biological tests, and we'll go through two of these, the rabbit pyrogen test, where we actually use live rabbits in terms of injecting the potential endotoxin into the animal and monitoring it in terms of the development of fever. We also have the limulus amebocyte lysate test, a very interesting one. We'll talk a little bit about its history. It's probably the major test that has been used since the 1970s for detection of endotoxin. There's also a neutrophil chemiluminescence test, which is essentially a cascade biological in vitro test for detection of endotoxin. And then we also have, in terms of non-biological endotoxin detection, we have chemical markers where we look at various fatty acids or conserved parts of lipopolysaccharides, especially the polysaccharide part of it, to determine these particular chemical structures. We can also look for detection of specific molecules in terms of, for example, enzyme immunoassays or other sorts of presentations, especially on molecules or antigens that are secured to some sort of stationary media, and use that to detect molecules that are specific for LPS or lipopolysaccharides. In terms of the biological test, the rabbit pyrogen test has been used for most of the 20th century. And it was the standard test for pyrogenicity. The test took about 4 hours, and it was accomplished by injecting the pyrogen into a rabbit's ear. The analysis was to determine if the animal developed a fever, and that would then confirm the presence of pyrogens. This is a strong test in terms of the development of a biological response. It's also caused concern over the years in terms of animal use in testing, and especially in routine testing for pharmaceutical products. In the 1970s, the next step in terms of development of these detection methods for endotoxins came about with the limulus amebocyte lysate test, and this was based on a serendipitous discovery by some marine researchers about the coagulation reaction of several marine species of bacteria with the blood of the Atlantic horseshoe crab. This particular coagulation event was then studied as being a marker, a biomarker, for the presence of gram-negative bacteria, and specifically lipopolysaccharides. It was commercially introduced in the 1970s. In 1977, the LAL test, as it's referred to, was mandated by FDA for endpoint product tests for human biological products and medical devices. How they do this, they actually obtain blood from the horseshoe crab, so there is a bleeding event of a few milliliters, I believe it's about 30 milliliters from the crab, and this particular blood is then processed. The blood cells, the amebocytes are separated, and they're lysed to obtain the cellular proteins that are impacted in terms of the presence of endotoxins. There's very specific ways to use LAL tests and to use these particular proteins to get the amount of endotoxin. In a simple gel clot LAL test, we find that it just yields provides a simple positive negative. We see a clot, it's positive for pyrogens. There's a chromogenic endpoint that offers an LAL quantitative test lipopolysaccharide quantitative result, and it's a different analysis using the same basic horseshoe crab protein. Another approach is the kinetic turbidimetric LAL test. This also gives quantitative results, but there are some problems in terms of sample compatibility and its application with, for instance, blood samples. There's also a kinetic chromogenic LAL, which does allow for automation and greater sensitivity down to about 1 picogram of lipopolysaccharide. There are some limits to the biological tests in terms of examining or detecting endotoxins. This particular approach cannot be used for diagnostic testing of blood or other body fluids. It can't be used when analyzing concentrated salt solutions, like might sometimes be used as lutens in medicine. It can't be used in the testing of chemicals, which typically have concentrated impacts on the protein itself, and it can't be used in solutions of various proteins. And so in these cases, these non-biological endotoxin detection methods, the chemical methods of specific immobilized enzyme tests or antigen tests or direct chemical analysis, these are the types of detection methods that are used. I can finish up here today giving you an example in terms of an application of endotoxin analysis. This is actually an LAL test in ground beef. This is from Applied Environmental Microbiology, 1979. This is the result of testing of about 90 samples. These samples, as you can see, had ranges in terms of the anaerobic plate counts, log anaerobic plate counts, from less than 5 up to greater than 7, so the factor of a 100-fold difference or so in the amount of bacteria present. In terms of the relationship to the mean endotoxin detected by LAL test, the quantitative assessment in terms of mean endotoxin appeared to be somewhat exponential in terms of the growth of the nanograms per gram, ranging from about 50 to about 7,500 nanograms per gram. So that gives you at least perhaps a brief introduction to bacterial toxigenesis. Again, probably not particularly satisfying to those of you that have a substantial background in microbiology. But what the intent of the lecture was to do is to examine these toxins from a toxicology perspective, as chemicals having an impact on biology. we've kind of tried to take a look at the relationship of endotoxins and virulence in terms of protein toxins, but also the generalized cascading immunological inflammatory effects of endotoxins and their potential risk in terms of food production. For example, in the human food chain, we typically are reasonably fastidious about controlling microbial growth in terms of refrigeration and preservation. A decade or so ago, there was some great concern about pet products, dog food, if you will, and the lack of management of those similar sorts of concerns, and then the substantial amount of pyrogens that were detected in some pet foods. This gives us a good stopping point in terms of bacterial toxigenesis. What we'll try to do in some further lectures is look at some other chemicals in terms of contamination of the human food chain and its potential for food toxicology. With that, thank you so much. We'll see you later.